Hello, and welcome to Eyes on Success, a weekly program of information on the ever-changing world of accessibility. Now here are the hosts of this program, Nancy Goodman-Torpey and Peter Torpey.
Hello, I'm Nancy.
And I'm Pete. Well, this week we'll be talking with a professor from the University of Colorado who works in the field of HCI, or human-computer interactions. In particular, his research is focused on making interactions between visually impaired people and their computers or other technologies a little bit easier.
We'll speak with Sean Kane about some of his recent projects, including first, understanding how blind people communicate when navigating, and later about 3D printers and how they can be used for the blind. But first, for our tip of the week. This week's tip is keep abreast of new ideas, technologies, and research in the field. Because just because something is impossible now doesn't mean it always will be. Some new ideas and research may benefit you in the future. And you might be able to get yourself into a position to provide feedback at an early stage of the research that could benefit everybody down the road.
I constantly scour the internet, keep abreast of new technologies and new devices created for the visually impaired. Our show is an excellent resource to find out about some of these new products and new developments, but there are also many other resources on the net, and you should keep abreast of these because some of these new technologies might just help you do some of the things more easily that you're trying to do now.
Let's start by meeting Sean Kane and learning a bit about his research in general before we go in more detail into two of his recent projects.
My name is Sean Kane, and I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Computer Science at the University of Colorado Boulder. I think last time you spoke to me, I was an assistant professor at UMBC in Baltimore, Maryland, but I have just recently moved to Colorado.
And I think the time before that, you were a graduate student in Seattle.
Oh, I believe that. Yes, that's true. That's true. So now from the west to the east and now back somewhat to the west.
And you can actually tell that Sean just moved into his new office because it's kind of echoey, and that's because the furniture hadn't gotten there yet.
Now, our initial connection with you was through another professor at the University of Rochester, Jeffrey Bingham, and you guys are both into doing accessibility research, and in particular, I guess a lot of your work is focused on human-computer interactions, sometimes abbreviated HCI. Can you talk a little bit about the range of your work and the scope of what you do?
Absolutely. So I am a professor of computer science, and so I'm interested in designing computer systems, and those include both hardware and software. But a lot of the work that I'm really interested in is finding places where existing solutions just don't quite work for people. That it's often people with disabilities, but can include older adults, younger kids, and other folks. And a lot of this work really involves how do we change how we interact with a computer application or a mobile device or a wearable device and try to create ways of interaction that are more accessible and more usable by a variety of people. And so an example of that is looking at a smartphone with a touchscreen. And if we think back to the dark ages, when we saw touchscreen smartphones, they weren't accessible to people who were blind or visually impaired because the entire user interface was displayed visually. And to interact with it, you had to look at the screen, figure out what you wanted to interact with, and touch where you were looking. And one alternative to that is really to use sound or vibration or other types of feedback. And sure enough, actually, many of those devices and smartphones have those capabilities already. But the challenge is really just to design the right types of applications and the right types of interaction for the population that we're working with. The fact that many of the objects that we have now have computer chips in them, now have more computing power than they used to. And also one thing we see quite a bit with mobile devices and wearable computers and even our laptops and PCs is they're starting to have all kinds of interesting sensors in them. So you can detect with a camera who is using a piece of technology. You could potentially detect where the person is, and you could detect what kinds of activities they're doing. And that allows us to make technology that's a lot more flexible and adaptable to individuals as well.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. Success, 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 success.
This week's focus topic is a study that Sean is doing in collaboration with Michelle Williams about how a visually impaired pedestrian communicates while navigating in an unfamiliar environment.
So today we wanted to talk a little bit more specifically about some of your recent research projects, and we thought maybe we'd start out with a project that you're involved in about helping the visually impaired navigate and how they communicate with a sighted person. Can you give us sort of an overview of what that's about?
Sure, I'd love to. So for the past several years, I've been working with my colleagues at UMBC in Baltimore, and you know, I'm the professor, and so a lot of the hard work is actually done by the students, of course. And so the student who has been primarily responsible for this research, her name is Michelle Williams. She will be graduating this year and will be on the job market. So if you're interested in this research, please contact me and I'm happy to get you in touch with Michelle. One area of work that Michelle is particularly interested in, which is a problem that faces many people, is independent navigation. And how do individuals navigate through spaces that are unfamiliar to them or only somewhat familiar to them? So we conducted a study looking across the United States at both rural and urban locations, white cane users, but also sighted guide and guide dog users, and tried to understand, well, what kinds of questions did they have and how could technology help them navigate more independently? And so we were thinking about this space, and one idea that we came up with was, well, what can we learn about designing technology to support navigation based on how people interact?
What was the original impetus for this project?
Part of this research actually came from a personal experience that I had. I was visiting the National Federation of the Blind Jernigan Institute in Baltimore. I was going to visit some of my friends there and was in the lobby and saw a couple, and they were an older couple, and I believe the wife was visually impaired and her companion was sighted, and he was describing the space to her where they were in the lobby of the Jernigan Institute. And he was using all these shortcuts and shorthand about the space. And he said, oh, this space is laid out similarly to, and he was talking about some other place that presumably they had been to before. And I just thought this was really cool. And when we think about technology, and existing navigation technology, you really have a one-size-fits-all kind of solution. And so we were quite interested in understanding these personal interactions.
In this research that you've been doing, have you differentiated between a blind person with their principal sighted companion, so like Pete and me, versus a blind person and a sighted companion with whom they don't often walk around?
That's a really great question. And for this work, so we really just started to explore this area. And so we worked with a number of participants with different types of relationships. And so we had some individuals who were with partners or spouses, one person who was with their child. And so some individuals who lived together, but also individuals who were friends or activity partners. And so we had both people who knew each other quite well and people who didn't know each other quite so well.
How did you actually do the study?
The activity we had them do was a little bit artificial. So we wanted to put them in a situation where they would leverage each other in going through this activity, but also one in which would be somewhat new to them and in which they had to interact. And so we had them walk through some public spaces. So we had some of our research participants go through a shopping mall. So a shopping mall has all kinds of fun obstacles and distraction and noise, and can be a very complex space and crowds. And then we also had some individuals who went through a more quiet environment and actually went on a campus tour, which is quite convenient because we work at a university, and went through different types of spaces, so indoors and outdoors. We had them walk through a sculpture gallery, an art gallery, and talk about the art. And in this case, we actually tended not to have people necessarily directly do sighted guide, so that was more where the sighted partner was really leading and bringing the person around, but for them to walk together and talk together. So this was a slightly artificial interaction, but you know, that's not how they might go through the space normally, but to give us a sense of the conversation and to encourage the conversation about where they were going, about navigation, and so forth.
Well, that's interesting, because every once in a while we'll be out somewhere and Pete will go off with another person, or so I get to see him following another person who isn't me. And my observation is that because he follows me so much of the time, I say much less than the people who know him quite well, and they're good friends, maybe even his kid, but the people who don't guide him anywhere near as often. To the extent that a lot of what I say, I don't even say. I just know if I move my arm like this, he knows that there's a curb coming up. And people are always flipping out. It's like, Nancy, you didn't tell him about the curb. I'm like, did he trip?
Right, right.
You know, it's interesting. You talk about so much of the communication being nonverbal. We had an experience about 10 years ago. We've been married for about 30 years now. And after we were married for about 20 years, I was with Nancy's dad alone out in the garden. And we were talking and he said, you know, it's really great the way you two get along and you have such a nice relationship. He says, I just don't understand that, you know, I would think she'd give you more hints about when the stairs coming up or curbs. And she doesn't seem to help you in those circumstances because I don't generally use my cane when I'm with Nancy. But so much of our communication is nonverbal and really subtle that he had missed it after 20 years of us being married.
Right, right. So one of the things that came up in our study actually was that often the partners, I think especially this was true for partners who hadn't known each other for as long or hadn't interacted as much in this way, were often overly cautious and felt the need to have their visually impaired partners avoid boundaries and those kinds of things, or say, you know, watch out, those kinds of things. And so two aspects of that. One is just the verbal overload of saying, well, watch out for this, watch out for this, watch out for this. And oftentimes the other person wasn't even going anywhere near them, right? And so it was extraneous information.
Right. And I'll often get information overload from people that are less familiar with guiding me around.
And also it's a lesson in looking at misconceptions about what's helpful versus not.
So I assume there's lots more research to be done here to fully understand all of these interactions. But what kind of conclusions have you come up with so far that you think might be applicable to new technologies?
So I think one thing is the notion of speaking a shared language. And so in as much as the partners know a lot about each other, they can use that as a reference point for describing new places, describing directions, those kinds of things quite concisely. And that can really help if you look at, well, how do you introduce someone to a new place? How can you give them a sense of how something is laid out? These comparisons to what the user already knows can be very helpful, we think. And finding ways to incorporate that in technology, I think, can be quite helpful. And so there's often a lot in shared experience that we can draw from. And one other point I would say is really developing the right kinds of expectations about how to give feedback, when to give feedback, and those kinds of things. And often from a perspective of designing technology, we think about giving directions in a very systematic way. So if we're designing a GPS device, for example, well, how many seconds before someone turns should we give them the feedback? And I think one thing that we see, even in this fairly preliminary research, is that that's often a lot more nuanced than that. And there are a lot of factors that go into when to give information, when not to give information. And people can learn this about each other very quickly. And even in our study, we saw people got better at this activity over the course of a few hours. But with technology, we still have a barrier to finding the right kinds of intervals or giving the right kind of information at the right time.
And I would guess that there's a particular lexicon that might help. I know, you know, when Nancy and I do some more interesting navigational tricks like hiking through a mountain, she has a very particular lexicon for different kinds of obstacles and navigational issues that we may have to go through.
And it's a very small lexicon. We have up if he needs to step up, down if he needs to step down, duck if there's something he might hit his head on. And of course, you know, with only maybe 8 or 10 words in this lexicon, and lumps means anything uneven. because functionally that's really all that matters. Although if it matters that it's a root or a log, because that's functionally different to get across, you know, maybe I'll tell him that. But even with this very short list, occasionally I'll say the wrong one, and I'll say down when I meant duck, and he'll think he's stepping down, which of course he isn't, and whack his head on something. Or I'll just tug when I realize I said the wrong word and he's about to whack his head.
Right. One area that we quickly enter when we look at how to make navigation technology better and seem smarter is this issue of trust as well. And we've noticed that even just in the preliminary studies that we've run, is that the more reliable the information seems to be, the less filtering or the less care potentially is offered when following that, right? And so if you have something that works quite well a lot of the time, well, then people might start to trust that too much. And what happens if the device makes a mistake? And so figuring out that balance of when can you trust this feedback, when should you double check, and those kinds of things, I think is a really interesting issue, especially if we start to think about the better this technology gets, the more enabling it is and the more independence it can offer. But at the same time, the greater the dependence on the technology can be. And then we're putting more trust in the hands of the technology. And we have to figure out a way to deal with that responsibly.
Well, and you need the feedback, I think, between the guide and the visually impaired person. So like Pete says, we hike up mountains, we get into some places that people might find surprising. And so I'll often tell him which way is down, because there's sometimes a fairly noticeable fall off on one side or the other. And usually it's just for information, you know, don't put your cane over there because if you drop it, you'll never see it again. But every once in a while, we're in a place where the fall off is really steep and there's nothing to catch whoever falls off. And I think, you know, he needs to take it seriously. And so if he's acting like, yeah, the fall off's over there, okay, fine, you know, I'll actually, you know, turn to him and say, listen, this is serious. You need to pay attention to it. And it's kind of a balancing act. You know, we'd much rather just be chatting about whatever we're chatting about, and I don't want to interrupt the conversation too much. But sometimes if it's a safety issue, I feel like I need to interrupt ourselves.
Right. And I think that's one place where if we look at how current technology works, we don't have a lot of variation between sort of a subtle interruption and an urgent interruption. Just looking at our mobile phones, for example, right? Any kind of information that comes in, you'll get a vibration, you might get a sound if you have your phone unmuted. And if you give any kind of verbal directions, then they're all typically the same volume. They have an equal kind of weight to them. Whereas, you know, going back to your example of nonverbal or the physical cues, we have a huge array of, you know, intensity, you know, a gentle tug versus a, you know, really grabbing someone's arm and pulling them back. We don't have a lot of that flexibility in our technology right now. And it may be one area where we could actually do quite a bit better if we can figure out how to manage and how to really differentiate between something that would be useful to know and something that is really urgent and related to somebody's safety.
Now for this week's final item, some of Sean's recent research on applications of 3D printers for people with vision loss.
So we've heard a lot about 3D printers. Why should visually impaired people be excited about 3D printers?
One thing that is very exciting about it to me, as someone who's been a computer nerd since I was a teenager and now I'm a professor of computer science, is that we can write code and we can use computers and then produce physical, tangible things. And I think that's very exciting.
Can you describe what 3D printers are and what they can do?
You can think about a 3D printer essentially as a hot glue gun that can move around and be programmed, right? So it has a nozzle and has a tube of plastic, and it will melt the plastic, and then a little print head can move around in three dimensions and deposit melted plastic. And then if you provide layers upon layers of this plastic, then you can create physical 3D objects. And so one thing that you can do is you can 3D print Braille. And so you can print a plastic sheet, for example, and then 3D print Braille on top of that plastic sheet. So both the underlying sheet and the Braille would be a single piece of plastic from the 3D printer. We've had less success taking some existing object and printing Braille onto it, partly because the plastic, when it comes out, is about 400 degrees Fahrenheit, and you know, not a lot of materials respond well to having hot melted plastic squirted onto them.
That's toasty.
Yes, so it's a little bit of a challenge to combine materials, but we can print things like business cards that are from the 3D printer that have Braille on them, for example. So the entire card is actually made of plastic and has Braille embedded in it. So we can print Braille not only on sheets of plastic, but also on 3D objects. So one of our favorite giveaways from my research lab at UMBC are 3D printed Braille rings. So they're little plastic rings that have Braille printed around the border. And we can make Braille in different sizes. We can print it on curved objects. We can print it on models. We can print it on all kinds of physical objects.
And a couple of months ago, we did a show with Hobie Wedler. And among other things, he talked about building molecular models with a 3D printer with the Braille written right onto each bond, showing the bond length.
What other applications have you found for using 3D printers for the visually impaired?
So one area that our group looked at in the past was taking mathematical formulas and translating them automatically into tactile graphs. And since everything is routed through the computer, we can take something like a spreadsheet of data, or we can take a mathematical formula that someone has typed in, and we can print out a tactile graphic of that graph or of that data.
So you're talking about a plot here, or you're talking about a 2D representation of an equation?
So in this case, I'm talking about plots. So we can plot a curve, we can plot points. And one thing that's nice is we have a lot of control over how that's actually physically represented. So we can print variable levels of height. We can print in different colors, which can be quite nice. So one 3D printer can produce something made from multiple materials. In this case, multiple types of plastic or multiple colors of plastic. So we can print something that's a tactile graphic, but it's also high contrast. So for those who need something that has very high contrast, we can automatically print that.
Cool. What other applications have you found?
Another area that we've been looking at is actually using 3D printing as an output of a computer program that someone has written. So actually with Jeff Bigham, my colleague, who is now at Carnegie Mellon University, we ran some workshops last summer where we were looking at how we could use the 3D printer to help get kids more interested in computer science. So computer science is one of the fastest growing and one of the still growing fields in terms of employment. And one of the ways that a lot of mainstream organizations get young people excited about programming is often through things that are very visual. So teach them to program games, or teach them to program animations or other kinds of visual content. And that's great, and that gets a lot of people interested in programming. But if you're visually impaired, that content's not necessarily going to be accessible to you, and it's probably not going to be as engaging to you as something more accessible. And so we are actually looking at how could you get kids to program and then take their computer programs that they wrote and turn that into a 3D print? In this case, we had them write programs to analyze data about a map and then print a tactile map. And it went with some help from our students and from some programs that we wrote. We could take a student's program that analyzed the map data and then from that actually generate a 3D printed tactile map that they could see and touch and figure out whether their code was working correctly or not, or so forth.
That could be very engaging for a young person.
Yeah, I think, well, and as a not-so-young person, I find it very engaging too. I think the ability to actually physically create something from a program that you wrote is I think, very exciting for a lot of people.
What other applications have you tested?
One project that I was really excited about is we actually did some work with folks from the Hubble Space Telescope Science Institute on making the images from the telescope accessible via 3D printing. And so we worked with some of the astronomers there to create some proof of concept 3D prints of images of different star clusters. But we made some fun toys. And one of the things that we made, which I was particularly proud of, was kind of a spindle, and it had different plates on it. And the idea was, if you imagine flying through the star cluster, well, how do we make something that's 3D that you can go through the different layers of? well, we could make something that's big enough that you could walk into it perhaps and feel around. But if you want something that sit on your desk, it may be difficult to see the different layers. And so we made these different plates that could stack together, and then you could flip through them and essentially fly through the area of space that they were capturing. That's a lot of fun to play around with and just kind of imagine that you're flying through this star cluster.
Sean, you're working on so many different exciting projects at once. If somebody wanted to learn more about some of these projects that you're working on, can you give your personal website?
Sure. So I'll give two websites, actually. So one is my personal site, and this has a lot of research reports that we write. And anytime anything's in the news or if I'm on a podcast, I link it up there as well. So my website is myname.info. So I'll spell it out. So it's shaunkane.info. I don't have the .com. Someone else has it. The real Sean Kane is the .info. The other page I'll direct people to, especially if they're interested more in the research side, is my research lab. And when I moved to Colorado, I decided I wanted a new research lab name to represent the research that we're doing. And so I called my lab the Superhuman Computing Lab. And the reason why I call it that is that I'm really interested in how technology can help us enhance our abilities. I'm also a little bit of a comic book nerd, so I was excited to talk about making superhumans. But you can go to my lab website from my webpage, seankane.info, or it's the word superhuman.cs for computer science, .colorado.edu. And I'll point you there if you're especially interested about the research itself or interested in getting involved in some of this research.
And if somebody wanted to contact you, I assume you have contact me information on both websites, but can you give it here also?
Sure. So the best way to reach me by far is by email. And so my email address is Sean, S-H-A-U-N, dot Kane, K-A-N-E, at colorado.edu. I also am reachable by phone, area code 206-923-8306.
Do you want to encourage people to check out your Twitter feed?
Oh, that's a great idea. Yes. So I am on Twitter. My Twitter username is my name, Sean Kane. So S-H-A-U-N-K-A-N-E.
And as usual, we'll have all of that contact information in our show notes at www.eyesonsuccess.net. In addition, we've done several interviews in the past with Sean Kane about his research and with Jeffrey Bigham about his research, and we'll have links to those shows, along with a show we did with Hobie Wedler, who's a PhD candidate in computational chemistry, and the work he did to use 3D printers in his research.
That's it for show number 1446. Next week on Eyes on Success, we'll be talking about disability rights advocacy. We will speak with Habin Girma, a deaf-blind attorney who works in the field of disability rights advocacy, filing class action suits when necessary and doing successful negotiations whenever possible. If you have any questions regarding something you've heard about on the show, or you'd like to share an idea for a future show, send an email to hosts@eyesonsuccess.net or call us at 585-258-0333, and we'll try to address your question in an upcoming program.
You've been listening to Eyes on Success, hosted and produced by Nancy Goodman-Torpey and Peter Torpey and distributed by WXXI Reach Out Radio. For detailed information or a full archive of programs, visit www.eyesonsuccess.net. You can also follow us on Facebook and on audioboo.fm at Eyes on Success or Twitter at @_EyesOnSuccess. We hope you will join us again next week for more information and updates on products for accessible living. Thanks for listening to Eyes on Success, and have a nice day.